It's been a little bit. I've been putting this off for a while, and I don't have a whole bunch of, as I said, the last few times, I don't have a lot of very specific notes. I have sort of a few things that I've written down here, but sometimes don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good enough. And so it's Friday, and I'm hoping to get outside. I had a delivery of some river rocks this week, and I'm making heart-shaped flower beds in my front yard and some other parts of my yard, and I've been battling English ivy and poison ivy pretty successfully, at least so far. I've removed a lot, and I haven't gotten a rash, so I count that as a win. And so I have some work to do outside with my shovel and my wheelbarrow. But before I go out and get all dirty, I wanted to just put a few thoughts in order, put some thoughts out there. I was talking with a friend a few days ago who works on a college campus, and this friend said, you know, I'm just a little bit concerned about next week, or, you know, what's going to happen next week? And I go, what's next week? So that shows you how out of the loop I am on all of the bigger happenings in the world. You know, I'm doing pretty good that way. Actually, I can say, unless you're really invested in one of those teams, being outside the loop works. And I'm having a really lovely fall here in Hot Springs, and I've met a lot of really nice people. A lot of them sort of older than me, but actually very vital and interesting and thoughtful people who have been very warm and inclusive. So I'm feeling really good about where I am. And thank you to people who have sent care packages and seeds and honey and things along to me. So I'm getting things all prepped for my garden for next spring, and I have a whole big bunch of seeds in the cabinet behind me that I'm waiting. I have three kinds of okra. I talked with someone who's a native Arkansan, and he said, you know, yeah, if you're growing okra, you'll fit right in here in Arkansas. And I do love okra. So I have my work cut out for me, and I was grumpy because today I walked out of my front door, and there were crazy geoengineering everywhere, which doesn't happen a lot here. You know, it's like total over-the-top Philadelphia-style geoengineering. So that was a bit of a bummer. So now everything is sort of grayed out. And, you know, it's so frustrating, the whole, like, environmental climate change end-of-the-world conversations that we can't even talk about what they're doing up in the skies. But anyway, there's still some sun out there to be had, so I'm going to go out shortly. But I wanted to throw out a couple of things. Initially, I wanted to talk a little bit about Robert Anton Wilson, the science fiction writer who was highly influential in the Extropian movement, sort of the libertarian Silicon Valley cryogenic preservation folks. And then I want to talk a little bit more about this online archetypal card playing game promoted by Earthwise. It's called Elowin.
5 different unique decks. And that means that some of the decks that you make, they have strategy, for example, that are based on regeneration and healing. Other ones are more on reversal of time. Other ones are on token rewards. So you have different kind of card decks with different gameplay experiences. And you have spell cards. So a minion, this is what you see here. So the minion card, as soon as you play it, the effect will happen in the next turn. A spell card, the change is happening as soon as we play it. Or he has not been able to earn the EVA. Had he now won the match, he would have earned some EVA there. And that EVA is now on testnet, but then it will be on the mainnet, which means it will become a real token in your account as soon as the token has been launched.
And essentially it's some sort of quest-based game to train benevolent AI that is connected to SingularityNet.
Hello, I'm Dr. David Hansen, and I'm pleased to talk with you today about how important the Elowin game is. I've been researching artificial intelligence for 30 years and have been seeking to achieve a kind of wise machine that could be good for humanity. I think this is really important during this time. There's no project in the world that is more well aligned to solve these problems and to enable people to solve these problems through gamification than the Elowin game. So I highly endorse this game. I'm happy to be part of this, developing AI and also serving as an advisor on the project. If we do this project, then it's not just a few of us. It engages the world to solve the world's hard problems. This is an incredibly compelling prospect for a business as well as for a social movement. AI needs this.
And Ben Goertzel. And this is something, I believe maybe it was Sean that brought it to my attention. I can't remember. It was either Steffers or Sean. I'm thinking maybe it was Sean. Then later, Joseph Gonzalez, BantamJoe.com, he had written some about it. But then in a strange turn of events, it turns out that somebody I used to organize with is closely connected with an advisor to that project.
So I've been a steward of Earthwise for, I guess, about 2 years now, and have been observing and also watching with bated breath as the game itself progresses. I'm very familiar with the fact that the backing from SingularityNet and Dr. Ben Goertzel, it has been instrumental in elevating the profile of the game. I also know the game is based on the future archetypes and this notion that humanity is moving into this fifth epoch, and that this will be an era of partnership and peace. We could say it's the prophecy time, which just seems, you know, almost there at the edge of our fingertips. The game, I feel, is instrumental in assisting us getting into this fifth paradigm, because first off, not only do we need to know our purpose in being here at this particular time, we need to play. We need to bring back this sense of adventure. And the game does that. We, the people, have lost so much power, and the institutional realm has gained so much power. And now we're seeing these institutions going authoritarian, back to Moloch. At the moment, Moloch seems to be winning the game. However, we the people do have the power.
And so it's just, it kind of overlaps with this idea of reality tunnels. And I wanted to sort of lay this out because I think these days there's so much apocalyptic narrative going around of all kinds, right? There's the, you know, it's going to be the end of the world, the Greta Thunberg version, end of the world because of climate. There's the, maybe the conservative Christian, Judeo-Christian, it's going to be the end of the world and the apocalypse. There's the New Age. They don't exactly say it's going to be the end of the world, but they say, like, we're doing a shift to some other consciousness, which is essentially at the end of the world as we know it, right? And then I'm sure milling about all of the election stuff going on, you know, there's some anticipation of, like, oh, it's the end of civilization. Somebody sent me, you know, something along those lines. And, you know, if you're unplugged and you're digging in the dirt and you're hiking around on mossy trails and things, you know, I'm not trying to put my head in the sand, but it's like the only thing that we can control is our consciousness and sort of what comes into our consciousness and how we are interpreting the world. And there are definitely some big things that if they happened again, like you can't go to the grocery store and get food unless you show me your digital passport or things like that. That would not be good. But at the same time, on a day-to-day basis, there's nothing I can really do about that. You know, I've realized there's nothing that I can, like, go to a city council meeting or protest or do an online video about it that's really going to substantially change it. So the only thing I can really control is how I navigate the information fields. So if you're stressed about the apocalypse, I just want to point out that Robert Bosnack, who was a Jungian connected to James Hillman and doing Hillman is the soul alchemist Jungian, and then Robert Bosnack later on was working on Asclepian healing caves and the embodied imagination and, you know, doing healing, group healing caves in virtual reality. And he had ties to MIT Media Lab. So Bosnack is saying, like, the apocalypse opens up lots of opportunities.
We are actually creating more in times that are more adverse. We become more creative. In 1983, I organized a conference called Facing Apocalypse. Facing Apocalypse was my first foray into organizing a conference about imagination and technology. when we did the conference in 1983, and it was well attended, and James Hillman talked in it, and we were talking about how every generation wants to believe that they live at the end of times because that makes them really important. It was attended very well by people like Claiborne Pell at the time, who was the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate. And he said, why don't we do this in Moscow? And I immediately said, yeah, let's do it in Moscow. So, and he could make all the connections, and it ended up in Moscow about 9 years later, but it ended up there. And so I said, I went to the microphone and I said, in 1986, we're going to do a conference about facing apocalypse and about the nuclear technology and the nuclear issue in Moscow. And people ran up to me afterwards and said, in 1986, we're going to be in nuclear winter. There's not going to be a world anymore. And so that very powerful notion of apocalypse, which apocalypse has this two things in it, right? It is both the notion of the end of the world, and it is the notion of revelation. So we get this revelation of the end of the world, and it's very convincing. The more people were talking about the year 2000, the more we felt that the apocalyptic fumes were rising. That is the way apocalypticism works. At the time, everybody believed it. Everybody believed that we were going to run out of food and that this was going to be the ultimate disaster. These kind of notions make people sit like, oh, I can't do it. So we have to realize that there is an imagination always underlying technology, and an important imagination is the apocalyptic imagination.
For the imagination, the active imagination. And so I would just lay out there that there are certain interests in the world for whom an apocalyptic narrative is, you can get people to do things if it's that they wouldn't normally do if they believe it's the end of the world, whether they believe it's an ascension end of the world or a fire and brimstone end of the world or rising oceans and, you know, melting glaciers end of the world. Like, all of these end of the world things are interesting opportunities for people who would like to capture your attention and direct you in a certain way. So just be mindful of that. You know, be mindful of the apocalypse, because it's a tool. It's a tool to steer group and individual consciousnesses. So I want to mention this guy, Robert Anton Wilson. And I'm reading a fictional book by Neal Stephenson, but it involves cryogenics. And I was like, oh, yeah, that Robert Anton Wilson guy, because he was a science fiction writer, among other things. And I kind of put off, like, he collaborated with Timothy Leary. And, you know, Timothy Leary, besides the LSD, he was interested in a lot of other altered states of consciousness that had to do with meditative practice and his Castalia Foundation. And so I kind of put it off, like, because the Extropians are sort of libertarian and, like, it just wasn't appealing to me. And I thought, oh, is this going to be some kind of Ayn Rand? He had a book published in 1983 called Prometheus Rising. And I thought, oh, is this going to be like an Ayn Rand kind of knockoff thing? It wasn't that appealing to me. But because I was reading this book that mentioned, they called it the Utropians, but it was clearly a reference to Extropians, I thought, oh, let me check this out. And I thought Prometheus Rising was a fiction book, but it's not. It's a nonfiction book. It was from 1983, and I'm working on a quilt. I'm sewing it up, so I bought the audiobook. And I have to say, the guy's a trip. The reader, I don't know how the actual Robert Anton Wilson sounds, but this guy had a thick New York accent and very kind of sarcastic. And for some people, it might be a big turnoff, but for me, I actually found it kind of amusing. And so it was a really enjoyable audiobook. And so he was laying out sort of an approach to sort of our consciousness or how we operate in the world. And I'm not going to say this is like the end all be all, or I totally endorse all of this, but what I like to do is encounter new information and new ideas and new people and how they think about things, and then compare it against the tools I have in my toolbox and say, oh, well, this could be a useful tool in some circumstances to try on this lens. That doesn't mean it's the only lens that I use, but it's like, oh, well, you could think about it this way. And then if that opens up either more possibilities or gives you some comfort or gives you some empathy or compassion for other people that you're dealing with, that's a good tool, right? And so I would say that this book, Prometheus Rising, offered some interesting tools for my toolbox, and I wanted to share them with you because I think in the coming days of the aftermath of, like, whatever election get in, it might come in handy. And, you know, I just want to point out that really in the election season, especially looking into, like, Nicole, and I know that thing has sort of petered out for the moment and they've gone into the background, but ultimately this narrative is driving towards digital governance, towards Web3 tokenization, towards AI digital twinning, and radical participatory voting. And that is because that is how the global superorganism is going to run. And I don't have a time frame on that. I can't say, oh, this is going to happen in the next 3 years or 5 or 10 or 20, but I'll probably see it in my lifetime. And they will steer the narratives in whatever direction they need to steer and hand the election to whoever they need to hand it to, back and forth, to enact the Web3 protocol layer, which is cybernetics. And Joseph on BantamJoe.com has been doing some really nice blog posts, detailed blog posts about consciousness lately. And it's nice to have another person who's interested in sharing information publicly about the whole consciousness and quantum computing and exploring these ideas about us being nodes in a massive parallel computer. And, you know, there's a concept that Steffers introduced me to, is this idea of qualia. And this idea of qualia is actually specifically referenced in this Neal Stephenson book in the early chapters, which is strange, right? I mean, I feel like all of Stephenson's books are really encoded guidebooks to what is unfolding. And he spends several pages of one of the main characters he's knocked off early on in the book, but that how he loves qualia, which is essentially our individual experience, tactile, sensible qualities. And part of the qualia was him in Seattle walking through a drizzly day and it's fall and he's appreciating the leaves, and then the fractal quality, and the fractals are important. It's about recursion, and that's something that Joseph touches on in his blogs about consciousness, his recent blogs over the past month. This fractal aspect. And it's this qualia of his specific perspective, right? And so, like, our experiences would be vary based on our lives up to that particular moment, our preferences, the associations we have with things. Some people may have, you know, like a cat rub up against their legs and they miss their cat that they've had for forever, and the qualia of that experience of petting the cat that's rubbing against the legs would be wonderful, like a very affirmative thing. And then some people may be allergic to cats. They may have been, like, scratched by a cat and got a cat scratch fever or something. You might have a cat rubbing against the legs or whatever and tripping them up might be a really bad experience. And so it's the same kind of interaction, but the qualia could be very different depending on who you are. And so this speaks to an idea that Robert Anton Wilson talks about in his book, The Reality Tunnel. So, but before that, I do want to just touch on, so the core of this book, in the audiobook that I listened to, it's multiple chapters and they go over these 8 stages of development, which, again, I'm not saying this is the thing, but it's interesting to think about because it sort of combines sort of the chakra stuff also with like developmental psychology and your Maslow's hierarchy needs or things. So it's kind of overlapping a lot of these, but it's not exactly any one of them. And so it's 8, and the 4 lower areas are having to do with being more the material and the grounded, and then the upper 4 are more etheric and spiritual, and so they balance each other out. And I would say most people, because you start out at the bottom in the grounding, like, you may gradually make your way up, but very few people get all the way to the top, which is like quantum co-creation. And what I would say is I think that this quantum co-creation is going to be embedded in the ascension narratives that are going to be baked into sort of interfaith ecumenicalism across all of the world religions. And then it'll be woven into game mechanics and token engineering and the digital voting, which is why I'm kind of laying this out in the context against the backdrop of the, you know, days leading up to the election, the presidential election, that they're moving us into a digital governance, but the tokens, the votes, the money, the chits, it's a signal. And this is a signal that is coordinating this noetic organism, this Gaia superorganism. And a lot of people get caught up in the Gaia and the New Age stuff in terms of esoteric or anti-Christian or those sorts of things. And that I'm not so much interested in that. I'm not advocating that. I don't really want to be incorporated into part of a superorganism. And they're certainly not talking about it openly, but that seems to be the case. And what I'm realizing is that this conscious evolution that Barbara Marx Hubbard, and she's connected into this, conscious evolution, conscious capitalism, conscious capitalism with a token economy is a coordinating signal that's going to relate to the second half of what I talk about, this Elowen game. And I do believe that if you try on the lens, and again, I'm not saying it's definitely correct, but if you try on the hypothesis that by us being nodes in a massive parallel processing computer and us each offering our qualia, our distinct experience, our view of the elephant, you know, touching around on the elephant from where we're standing into a token consensus along the lines of like bacterial biofilm quorum sensing, to use these tokens to manifest certain aspects of reality. And through, again, our embodied distributed intelligence connected in with a protocol layer, and that at scale, at a global scale. And I feel like that's what's going on. And so the quorum sensing aspect is an economic reckoning. It is a signal process. And it's sort of meeting a certain threshold of manifestation. So it is, like I keep saying, that I feel like this is a language of manifestation, and it is, but writ large, you know, and the conscious evolution connects to second order cybernetics, which is the cybernetics of cybernetics. So you run a process and then you get the result and then you feed that back in, and so that you further refine it. And so when you think about these terms of regenerative finance, regenerative agriculture, or even lifelong learning, I feel like that these are actually references to a second order cybernetic program, a system of systems, a fractal, a recursion, which is something, again, that Joseph goes into in his blog posts. And so just keep that in mind, that this conscious evolution does link into libertarianism, but it also links into this idea of a moral economy and spirituality, because I think this idea of a noosphere processor, quantum information processor or organizer, only works if our hearts are in it, and our heart is a 4D information processing system, the Taurus field. It's operating across time. And so in order for it to work, we need to be engaged in the system in a way that feels as if our participation was just, was good, was important, was helping others, was helping the environment, was saving the world. And all of the narratives, depending on which reality tunnel you're in, we're going to talk about the reality tunnels, that being a good person, you would embody the archetype of being the good person depending on what your position was around the elephant or in which reality tunnel. And that in order for this system to work, I think that your consciousness needs to be aligned with your heart, and that's important. And so that's why the spiritual aspect, the organized religion, the Peter Drucker's, the management theory being the superorganism processing, connects with the megachurches, because they're sort of fractals and these nested holons within this larger guided consciousness. And what I would say is, and what I keep repeating, is that I'm not comfortable moving forward on this concept because I think most people have no idea of any of these ideas that are in play. They don't know the history. They don't know the origins. They can't project forward the implications, whether they be possible opportunities or possible really bad things that could come out of it. And in order for this to happen, it's an entire world. And it's not just the humans. It's all the other beings that we share the world with, the nature. And it's the unborn that are coming after us, because once we template the world for the protocol layer with the nanotech and the frequencies and all of these things, the people who show up next are going to be living in this thing that we built. And we're not prepared to talk about it. And so, you know, it may be, like, I still believe that there is a benevolent God that is guiding the process. But I also believe that there's something in us that we have to be responsible participants. We can't just sit back and say, oh, God's got it. I'm just going to, like, sit here and eat my popcorn until it's over. Like, we're supposed to be engaged, and it's very difficult because it's a super-duper complicated process, and I don't know how to do it properly. And, you know, as... You know, I'm sitting here in an area that's very much sort of ascension leaning, right? It's both the Baptist side, and then there's the New Age side. And I'm not in any of those tunnels, per se. I'm sort of dipping in and out and trying to piece together a bigger picture. And, you know, I've said before, a story that most people are not interested in joining in on. Okay. So Robert Anton Wilson, these eight levels. So the first one is biosurvival state. So you're a baby. It's the mother, the breast, the food, the basic resources you need to stay alive for another day. And that's the first most basic one. And then the second is territorial and social, which is you have the wherewithal now to perambulate and to move your body, to get around, to pull up on the couch and take a, you know, walk down the couch and to the chair and around the living room and start to get a survey of the domain, the environment that you're in. And so it's territory, and it's where you're navigating space, and then what's in that space, is it dominating you or can you dominate it? And it's sort of a back and forth. And so that's a more maybe patriarchal aspect to that, the territorial and social. And then next is number three is the intellect. And so engaging your thought process and your consciousness with the world that you're in and anticipation and thinking. The next is the sexual aspect, reproduction, family, that aspect. The five is the pleasure of the senses, just for pleasure's sake, sort of hedonism. Six is multidimensional consciousness and spirituality, including out of body. So now we're moving up and out into the etheric sort of realms, as away from the material physicality of the basic needs and into a more spiritual space. Seven is a more mystical access to the intelligence of the universe, God source, how you understand that is being open and available and in conversation with intelligences that are beyond the material that is seen in terms of like mystic access. And then this, the top one, eight, is that you become a co-creator with this quantum field. And I believe that this conscious evolution is somehow using this protocol layer and game mechanics and behavioral psychology and interface spirituality to put some sort of training wheels on us to get us to be quantum co-creators, but on behalf of maybe a system that we don't understand, like an intelligence that we can't comprehend at this point. I don't think the role of the conscious evolution movement is that we all independently get to create for ourselves, that it's for a larger information processing manifestation program that we don't know that much about. So I feel like that's where things are headed. And so what Robert Anton Wilson said, and it actually connects with this guy, Robert Rosen, that I just encountered, who is a systems biologist and sort of biophysics and math. And it seems like he was also doing early work. He was, I've lost the guy's name. He was his mentor at University of Chicago. Like, they were dealing with some of the morphic field stuff that Levin was doing, but this would have been, like, in the 50s and 60s. and this idea of like the butterfly and the quantum biology, and that different generations of the butterfly know how to get back from Canada, even though their descendants departed from the ones that left Mexico, and that there's this information field, and that almost that we are tapping into information and drawing it to us. It's a more of a vitalist approach. And So it works with that and the Carl Friston, the free energy principle, which is, again, the body needs to regulate itself thermodynamically. And even though we might imagine that we sense things and then our brain puzzles over them and then we react to this like immediate sensory information, it seems that science has laid out that realistically we have a preconceived model of the world, and that when surprising information that is inconsistent with the model, novel information comes in, at that point we attend to it, and then we either adjust our model of the world to fit this new information, or we make a different sample and we go over there and we sample information that reaffirms the model that we already have. And that's necessary, because if we were constantly creating a brand new model all the time, like, we'd blow out our brain energy. And so most of the time we're on autopilot, and then we're only paying attention to certain things. But for me, this relates to this idea of the reality tunnel that Wilson offers, which is kind of along the lines of the same thing. I guess he was saying this in the early 80s, that reality is our perception. Like, we create our reality based on this model, right, that Friston later, you know, described in the free energy principle. But it's almost like none of us have the same reality. Like, we can be in the same environment with the same things happening, and we can perceive it incredibly differently, just like I mentioned, like with the cat rubbing on your legs or something, or, you know, somebody offers you, you know, a pumpkin muffin with walnuts, only you're allergic. So that's a really bad thing for you, right? Like, your experience is going to be different than somebody who absolutely loves walnuts and isn't allergic. It's all your interpretation. And so we're constantly getting new information and plugging it into the model, or and what rises to the top or what gets suppressed is based on our worldview. And he calls that a reality tunnel. And essentially, it's for the same reason. If we got up every day and the basic rules of our world changed, and we had to walk around the world and figure it out from scratch every day, we wouldn't survive. Like, we wouldn't survive. And so we live in culture. We have a culture. Like, today I went to Kroger and I stocked up on butter that was on sale and baked goods because I had a friend who gave me some extra carrots to make a carrot cake. And so I knew where to go to get my groceries. I didn't wake up and have to figure out, oh, I need something. Where do I go get it? I know where to go get it. I go to get it at the grocery store, or on Saturday I go to the farmer's market and I get fresh produce. And so we have rules of how things work, and that's culture. And I'm a cultural landscape person, and I love history and art and the humanities. I like culture, and I don't actually want there to be a one world culture. So we need a reality tunnel. But what I've been like thinking about is how we process information, right? Like, I've mentioned before that there's so much information coming through the feed and that we have access to, you know, and I mean, look at some of my maps. It's crazy amounts of information that I have access to now on the internet. And if people were so inclined, they could make crazy big maps of other things that were interesting to them. The things that interest me are kind of quirky and out there. They're a little bit non-typical. But I can make giant maps of all kinds of interesting information that's novel and interesting to me. And so that's information that I've sorted through that I make meaning with. I make patterns, right? I need to get back to it, but I was going through the Lindisfarne tapes of William Irwin Thompson, who is a early promoter of the New Age and who came to all of his lectures in the 1970s, and listening to the lectures and then making notes on it on a map, because that helps explain to me the context for conscious capitalism. I mean, it helps because I'm a historian and that's how I work through things. But it's information. And so, but since the advent of social media and community being online, instead of a reality tunnel where you're born in a mid-sized town and you go to school and for the most part I mean, there's might be a pecking order in the school, you know, but you understand how it works, and people are, you're all operating from a similar base of knowledge, right? And it's not huge. It's not expansive. It's not changing all the time. It's not grabbing your attention all the time. There's an understanding. You know, in the 19th century, right? Information. Well, there might be some broadsides. They might come out once a week, or you get a used copy and it's a month late. There might be, you might have access to a few books in a year. You might get a letter once a month from your sister who lives three states away. That's not a lot of information, right? And so there's not a lot of upheaval. And unless someone, like you're in Philadelphia and there's people coming in and out of port or whatever, or you, someone goes off to war and comes back with stories of like, hey, do you know out there they do it totally different than we do it? You wouldn't know. You would just be in a very pretty stable reality tunnel. And then we start expanding the signals, right? Why didn't World War One? Did the U.S. government like take control of all the radio? And you could just say it's about managing propaganda, but it's actually managing reality. The signal that comes through is the reality. So then you've got FDR, right? And the fireside chats, and everyone gathers around the radio, and it's to knit people together into a unified field, even though they're across many different reality tunnels. And then you have the instability of war and people going away for war and then coming back and realizing, wow, like there's things out there, there's stories out there that I could never have imagined, right? And then we move to like the Vietnam War, you know, and the, you know, that's on the nightly news, right? And then distant things are happening, and they're happening with an immediacy because you can hear them and see them in pictures and sound, and then you have to incorporate that. And then the social media feeds. And so now we've got all of these reality tunnels that are made of like very niche bits of information, like the free energy people, the active influence people are always talking about niche construction in society. That we've got like these super micro pico nano niches, right? Like you've got, it's like Hollands, right? You've got, you know, larger themes and then subgroups and subgroups and subgroups. And like, you know, I'm in like, you know, the little pinky end subgroup over here. And it's being fed by vast information flows, vast, right? That's coming in to keep you in your niche, or maybe like mostly keep you in your niche, right? You just go deeper and deeper and deeper. And one of the lines that was in the audiobook, the Robert Anton Wilson book, that I thought was really great about us making our reality is what the thinker thinks, the prover proves. What the thinker thinks, the prover proves. And I think that's interesting because, again, you could almost pick anything and prove it, right? Like I was making these giant maps and I was proving things about social impact finance and cybernetics. And it's not that they're not true. It's just then I began living in that space of that reality, even though in my daily life, I mean, there were times when it did affect my daily life because being in Philadelphia, those things did bleed over into things that did affect, you know, being on school councils and things like that. It wasn't like that they were totally disconnected, but they weren't immediate, you know, in that way. But I was living mentally in that space, in these space of these big maps, and the people around me and my family, they just weren't. They were in another reality tunnel. And so when my kids said that you left, that I left them, and I'm like, no, I was just in the living room. I was just on the computer. But actually, I guess in some ways I had left. I didn't think of it that way. But I want to just put that out there, this idea of the reality tunnel, because I feel like it's very different than the Plato's cave model, which I had sort of thought about early on. And there's an aspect of the Plato's cave model is that, oh, you're in a cave looking at shadows and someone goes out and they make their way out of the cave and they say, oh, there's more, but there's more. That's just shadows. There's more stuff out here. This is the real stuff, right? And they go back in the cave and no one believes them. And to me, there's like a sense of superiority in that you're smarter than them, or, you know, you made it, you know more than they do, and those dummies who are still sitting looking at the shadows. But the reality tunnel idea is like there's infinite reality tunnels, and we actually have to be in one. You know, we're born, and then we might navigate across different reality tunnels in our lives, but it's not like you can live in a vacuum. You're living in an environment that has a culture and the ways the world works, and then how you navigate that now in digital space and the physics of digital space is very different. But you're in a reality tunnel, and it's not that necessarily one is better than the other. And I know, like, early on, I was very absolute and difficult about all of these things. And, you know, I still have very strong feelings, but I can see now that certain people were just in a different reality tunnel. And so a lot of times when we kept trying to think of, like, why can't people hear us? Why, when we have very specific factual information, can they not see it? Can they not incorporate it? It's because I think the firmness of the reality tunnel and the fear, you know, these biosurvival fears and the territorial fears and the intellectual fears, that all of these base needs, that I think the most powerful military weapons really are behavioral psychology. Like, they're not guns. I mean, I'm not pro-gun, but the people who are laying out the what is unfolding are very, very, they spend a lot of money on sociologists and anthropologists and psychologists. They know how the mind works. And so if you make people very fearful, they're not going to leave their safe space. They're just not. No matter which cave you're in, right? Even, you know, and I can say, oh, I built the most beautiful map and it's full of all these amazing facts and that's that, right? But there's people who just don't want to engage with that. And I guess ultimately they don't have to. And so as we move into what I anticipate may end up being some sort of fractious moment, just, I guess, respect people's reality. Like, that's where you're at, right? You're in that space. And then within the tunnel, some people are really deep in the tunnel and they're really ensconced there. They can see nothing else. And then some people maybe are further out and they're more near the entrance and they see that there's some other holes in the, you know, cliff wall that they might explore. And to me, that's sort of where I am, dipping in and looking around and seeing what the view is from there and then pulling back. And, you know, I had someone ask me, so what's your story? Like, what is the story that you're promoting? And at this point, I don't know. I guess my reality tunnel is maybe the place where you can see that there are reality tunnels and acknowledge them. And again, not saying that that's a better reality tunnel than somebody else's reality tunnel. It's just, I don't know what the one story is because I have a pretty unique perspective on the world for now. So anyway, I offer that to you because I found it helpful, this idea of the reality tunnels that we inhabit and that we make our reality, and what the thinker thinks, the prover proves. So when someone is speaking to you from their place, it's their experience and their, as they speak and act in the world, they're building their world and rebuilding it and strengthening it and buttressing it. And so just maybe at a meta level, keep that in mind, right? And we don't all have to be the same. And that's a lesson that I think I've learned since the early part of the process when I was really panicked and upset about impact finance and everything, that I wanted everyone to, not everyone, but I wanted people to take into account this story and factor that into their story. And it wasn't going to happen because it's really not part of anybody's reality tunnel. Which brings me to the second part of the conversation today. Again, I think maybe Sean brought it to my attention. It's possibly it was Steffers, but I think it was Sean. And it was an organization called Earthwise. And I think that this stemmed from some of the maybe evolutionary leaders and the John Rogers work that he was looking at with Michaela Uluru. And this organization, Earthwise, is led by a woman who grew up in the Netherlands. Her name is, I guess, Anneloos, A-N-N-E-L-O-E-S, Smitsman. And Anneloos Smitsman with set up Earthwise. She had spent a lot of time in her career working with sustainable development goals and sustainability, and was also interested in psychology and consciousness, and had done a lot of her own sort of inner work and sort of shamanic journeying and various things. And it led her, she was very interested in democracy, right? So we're back to the tokens and the superorganism. And so she did graduate school work in South Africa, which is, again, a center of a lot of social impact finance. And early on, I was doing that research into Amply, which was the blockchain preschool that was backed by IXO Foundation and Sean Conway. And so there were some early things with South Africa.
Hi, I'm Sean Conway, and I'm the founder of Trust Lab, which is a technology startup based in Cape Town, South Africa, pioneering the use of blockchain technologies for development and impact. So there's some real value adds and some quite unique aspects of being partnered with the Innovation Fund at UNICEF. One of those is that the fund invests in a portfolio of very interesting frontier technologies that have that are pioneering in different areas of big data, drones, blockchain technologies. And when you look at how these technologies are emerging and converging, how they're coming together, you begin to see the multiplier effects. You use the data that's generated from that to feed back into the protocols that we're developing and to be able to ensure that the that impacts are being delivered on the ground. You know, those kinds of connections are uniquely available within UNICEF. And then once we have proven our technologies, UNICEF has the country presence and the distribution channels and the connections with governments and other organizations to be able to get our products into the marketplace where they're needed.
And then she left and she went to Australia and she did, I guess, her PhD work in Australia. And again, Australia has a lot going on with digital governance and social impact finance and education. And this Anlos Smitsman also worked very closely with Alexander Laszlo, the son of Irvin Laszlo, who was part of the Foundation for Integrated Education and a systems theorist and a promoter of the Baha'i and sort of conscious evolution. And so Alexander Laszlo, I think he was maybe in Argentina, and he was very active with, he has the Bertrand Laffney systems, so theory of systems. Remember, I was talking about regenerative finance and second order cybernetics, systems of systems. And I think they were also, he and Irvin had like a Giordano Bruno Institute. And he was also on the board with Tom Vander Ark and Pavel Luksha of the Global Education Futures Forum, which shout out to my friend in Maine, the former second grade teacher, because that was sort of the beginning for me. It was like, well, if you really want to go down the rabbit hole, click this link on Global Education Futures. And that was maybe back in 2016. And Pavel Luksha was the first person I ever saw to talk about transhumanism and the neural web and, I mean, crazy, crazy things. You should look up, just put in the search bar on my blog, Global Education Futures, and their logo is a tree. So Laszlo was with Pavel Luksha in Global Education Futures, and, you know, they have a timeline of, a lot of it's connected to blockchain and virtual reality and gamification. And, you know, it's just blowing my mind. And again, this is only maybe 8 years ago, but now it's like, oh yeah, of course, they're doing all the things that seem shocking that we're well on the way to that. And I happened to have occasion to want to share some information about Pavel Luksha with someone that I met this week. And so I was Googling some papers to send. And this is the reason I went back to this today. It turns out Pavel Luksha wrote an education paper with Anlos Smitsman of Earthwise. And so, again, it's all of this sustainability and education, and all of this will be aligned with the UN SDGs. And I thought, wow, Pavel Luksha, he definitely gets around, right? And so the thing that Sean had pointed out with Earthwise is that they had a blockchain game with quests and collectible cards, which is kind of like that sounds a bit like that game that I was arguing with Derek Bros about, the kids playing those card games, crypto card games. And that this one isn't play to earn. It's play. Essentially, you're playing the game to train a benevolent AGI, generalized artificial intelligence. And they have tokens and they have a DAO, and it's called Elowen. And Elowen is an elm tree, and it's built off of Celtic mythology. And so it's highly occulted. I mean, again, I don't do a lot of quest-based LARPy gaming, so I don't know how typical that is. But the cards are definitely archetypal. They're about spell casting. But again, the goal, it is sort of a collaborative game more than a play-to-earn game. This is how they're framing it, although I think you still, there's money involved. You have to buy cards and do different things. And it's linked to sustainability and thriving. And that somehow by participating in these card-playing quests, that there will be personalized support for your own personal development and consciousness development in this. And so the training the benevolent AI, now your opponent is Moloch. So Moloch is the antagonist in this and using all sorts of behavioral psychology tricks. So it strikes me a little bit as along the lines of the poker as the psychology gaming. And again, it's on blockchain. So you're going to have a digital twin of your archetype in there that the Moloch would have access to in terms of like screwing around with your brain and tempting you, right, with rewards that are against the common good. And this is sort of a commoning type of thing. And there it's in affiliation with SingularityNet, which is Ben Goertzel and David Hansen and Sophia the Robot. And a big aspect of this game is sort of time bending and countdown against clocks and bending time forward and bending it back and fighting over time. And, you know, I just want to point out that Julia Mossbridge was involved with Ben Goertzel on this Loving AI project that also involved time bending that had Sophia the Robot doing guided meditations with people, which is all intertwined with all of this conscious evolution stuff. And again, I'm not personally against the meditation, but it's like, tell me more about what this is all about and why, because there's big pieces that are missing that are incongruent with the story that you're telling. And so going back to Pavel Luksha and Annalise Smitsman, and so now Annalise Smitsman, who set up the Earthwise game, and this is kind of an extension out of her PhD work in quantum consciousness and sustainability, she's based out of Mauritius, which is a tiny island in the middle of the Indian Ocean off the coast of Madagascar. And it's one of these special, Sean sent me some links, special economic opportunity zones, and they're doing all sorts of sustainability tied to the ocean-based blue economy. And it just happens to be near an archipelago with the U.S. military base. And over time, it's been contested by France and England and various people, the Dutch, fighting over possession of this volcanic island. It has an underwater waterfall, which is interesting because this book that I'm reading has a lot to do with terrain and vortices and volcanoes and chaos. So this little island kind of embodies that. And there's a whole lot of smartness and like smart remote work and these various sustainable smart communities that are embedded. So they were doing education programs in Mauritius in connection with the Catholic Church. And they were funded by, I think, Investec, which is an Australian with a division in South Africa investment bank that had a foundation that was doing 40% of their investing in education. So then we're looping back to Global Education Futures and Alexander Laszlo and Pavel Luksha and Smitsman with this educational programming and then having the kids doing conscious evolution work, you know, with a lot of the mindfulness stuff that's going on in the schools these days and the social emotional learning stuff that is, I think, training them to be part of this quantum system. But again, I don't know if they had the kids fighting Moloch. I don't know if these quests were part of the school program or they had another division. So I'm looking at Luksha and I look back and I see on Earthwise, there's a woman, Laura George, who's listed as an advisor on this. And like, it just struck me, she's with the Peace Pentagon. And I thought, huh, that's interesting. The Peace Pentagon. Where do I know that from? And before the lockdowns, when I was doing, active organizing with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, and that was in Philadelphia. And the reason that I was doing that was that I tried to organize around the human capital finance with, you know what, I think I'm going to have to take a break because somebody's out there using either a power washer or I went and shut my front door. It's still warm enough that I can have the screen door open, which is super. But okay, so I'm looking at Laura George and the Peace Pentagon and I'm like, I remember this. And when I was organizing with PPERC and Sherry Honkala around housing rates, because again, the teachers were overwhelmed And they were in their reality tunnel. Their reality tunnel was the answer to our problems with education and technology is to take over our union for social justice. And so I couldn't get through to the teachers about that. So then I thought, well, this playbook for impact finance, which little did I know it was going to be running into quantum computing and subtle energy and token engineering, I moved over into the housing issues because I knew that the same playbook was being used in supportive housing, especially tied to the criminal justice division. And at that point, I didn't know about the outside-in robot. I didn't know about Gordon Pask. I didn't really understand about our interactions with the environment. But I did know, I might have seen about the Casita, the smart like cargo container home, and I knew that that was going to be a problem. And I knew that they were going to be targeting people in addiction and people returning from prison in the housing. And so I organized, I joined with Sherry, and I was serious. And this wasn't connected to Sherry, but there was another group that was organizing around the housing authority, which was very corrupt in Philadelphia. And like I even ended up getting arrested when one of the out of uniform housing officers was trying to chokehold a guy who had been protesting outside of the housing authority quarters. And so I did. I spent like, you know, a night in jail in the Philadelphia Roundhouse, which is not great. And then ultimately it all worked out. And I got to write a great like article about like alternative diversion court systems and how that's going to tie into impact investing. But at the end of the day, like the judge just said, no, like Allison, somebody needs to tell the truth. And you keep telling the truth. And so I'm still here, even though I'm on my own now. I'm still trying to tell the truth as I know it, even though I can only tell it from my reality tunnel, which is the tunnel where there it is known that there are reality tunnels. So I was pretty serious about it. I donated some, you know, time and resources, and I did do like a webinar on the welfare system, child protective services, and addiction in Connecticut, the pay for success work there, like a social worker's breakfast for them. But it never really went anywhere. And then eventually they were all in on the COVID stuff, and we just kind of parted ways. But even throughout that, Jason Bosch, he was more involved with Sherry and P Perk than I was, and he had helped with Sherry's campaign for sheriff and driven around on a lot of these larger events. And while we were doing all this work on impact finance and social token engineering, he kept trying to set something up with Sherry that we could talk about it, like on as a video. And it was never going to happen. It was just never going to happen. And it was disappointing, and I didn't really understand. But the reason I'm bringing this up today is that Sherry was invited to go to this Peace Pentagon, which this woman, Laura George, is part of like an ordained priest in the Order of Melchizedek. And it's very, very New Agey. And I don't have stuff technically against New Agey. It's not really my reality tunnel. But there's some stuff going on. That's why I was trying to track down sort of the origins of the New Age stuff. And Laura George's father was a high-level naval officer in Vietnam, and she's building this Pentagon, and it's all about like ecumenicalism and the sacred feminine and various things that, you know, on the one hand sound good, but she's connected very closely with the Human Potential Movement folks, and Barbara Marx Hubbard came and promoted her like 8 Wheel of Consciousness program, I think, and co-creation. And so it is all of this stuff that I'm talking about up here.
This Pentagon, supported by the Oracle Institute, is building a hub at the very center of the Wheel of Co-creation, whose purpose is to build a new world based on what's working. So the Oracle Institute is housing here in the Peace Pentagon a whole new version of the building of a new world. And it will become a model that can be replicated anywhere in the world. A war room maps enemies and how to defeat them. A peace room maps innovation, creativity, and newness, connects it, and communicates it. So the peace room here at the hub of the wheel will have a media hub. So that out of all the things that work, we will have key people come in and share what's working into the world, and they will share it from a field of love. I thought, it occurred to me that what we need is nonlinear exponential interaction of innovating elements in such a way that they could quickly connect with each other and jump the system to a higher order. It starts in the mind of cosmos, the mind of God, and it spirals up universe, earth, life, animal life, human life, every turn on the spiral, higher order, higher complexity, higher consciousness. And then this is our huge turn on the spiral. It's a wheel. And the core of the spiral is going through the hub and the heart of the wheel. And the hub and the heart of the wheel is our essence, our love, our spirit, our longing, and you might say the impulse of evolution thriving within us.
And I think this, she had this Oracle Institute that supports the Peace Pentagon. And the guy who's the director of the Oracle Institute, I'm trying to see where is, oh, Glenn Martin is a philosophy professor at Radford College, which I think is a small college in Virginia. But he's been working on a world constitution for years, I mean decades, this guy Martin. And so when I'm talking about the protocol layer and second order cybernetics and the Gaia hypothesis and the noosphere, that's a world constitution. And there's a lot of overlap with the United Religions Initiative. And the United Religions Initiative came out of the United Nations. It was launched in Pittsburgh, which, again, we're talking about the melons and archetypes. And Dee Hawk was the consultant on that. Dee Hawk, the founder of Visa, who was born and raised in Utah, and was talking about the chaotic age, right? Like chaos and order.
Chaotic organization refers to a system of organization that blends characteristics of chaos and order. The term was coined by our upcoming guest on the Innovation Show, founder and CEO emeritus of Visa, Dee Hawk. In this next clip, Dee explains what he means by a chaotic organization.
I define chaotic as the behavior of any self-organizing, self-governing, adaptive, non-linear, complex organism, organization, community, or system, whether it's physical, biological, or social, the behavior of which harmoniously blends characteristics of both chaos and order. And the second definition of it is the behavior of a self-organizing entity, the behavior of which exhibits observable patterns and probabilities that are not governed or explained by its constituent parts. And the third definition is characteristic of the fundamental organizing principles of the universe, evolution, and nature. That's a little complex, but it is the diametrical opposite of the command and control and top-down organizations.
And using digital signals, digital money for that. Now, your Visa card isn't blockchain yet, but this is all building up, right? And so Laura George is an advisor to this Elowen game. And I'll include the clip, but there's a clip of her like promoting this Moloch AI card playing game.
So I've been a steward of Earthwise for, I guess, about 2 years now, and have been observing and also watching with bated breath as the game itself progresses. I'm very familiar with the fact that the backing from SingularityNet and Dr. Ben Goertzel, it has been instrumental in elevating the profile of the game.
Through the Peace Pentagon, right? So, and of course, peace. I've talked a lot about peace and the Quakers and the American. Like, I don't want to be against peace. But ultimately, what they're not saying, it's a language game, is that peace is homeostasis in this global superorganism. That's peace, right? And what kind of peace is it? Do we agree that that's the peace we want? That we want a one world religion? That we want a one world diet? That we want a one world culture just in the name of peace? I don't think so. I don't think we decided that yet. So Laura George is connected, and there seems to be a direct connection between the Oracle Institute and the Peace Pentagon and Earthwise and this Elowen game. Again, a DAO, token engineering, archetypal, esoteric, right? And Annalos Smitsman is an advisor to the Oracle Institute, right? So I'm looking at the Oracle Institute's list of advisors. So there's a direct connection. Annalos Smitsman is on the Oracle Institute's advisor. But also, right next to that is Sherry Hankala of Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. And I'm just floored because here, this was someone who at the time, I mean, I'm assuming they still do, was talking about poor people's led, like the poor being the spokespeople against structural economic issues that keep people in poverty, including children, which is a huge issue in Philadelphia. Huge. And it's not getting any better with AI and the removal of jobs and gig work and remote work and telepresence labor. It's a problem. These are real problems. And I thought, okay, so they're against the nonprofit industrial complex. They were not about being a 501c3 and getting a bunch of grant money because Sherry in the past had been manipulated by these very same big power philanthropies, right? And Ford Foundation and et cetera, et cetera. So they were grassroots. For me, this felt real. Like my reality tunnel was, these were things that happened to me that we try to make sense out of. We try to tell a story. I go to the school board meeting about school report cards, and there are supposed to be 6 meetings, and I organize people even in the summer when they're not expecting people, and we push back, and they cancel all the rest of the meetings and have a focus group. And I go, that's not what democracy is, I didn't think. That's what not civic participation is, and that was the beginning of the journey for me. Was realizing that my entire understanding of the world was inaccurate. Like then it led to like every morning in the shower, I would have the radio on in the bathroom listening to NPR. And it was sponsored by all the same people who were taking apart our public schools, right? And setting up learning ecosystems for lifelong learning and token engineering and badges and all of this stuff. And oh, by the way, did we not tell you that all of the badges and all of that stuff came in the educational technology came straight out of the Defense Department, right? All of the things that, because I was really good. I was like, I wanted to be the good person. And I think we all kind of do. It's like, tell me what a good person looks like and I'll jump that hoop, right? I'll do it the best I can, right? And then all of that crumbled. And I fortunately at the time still had enough relational support and financial support and time to pick myself up and to rebuild new stories, right? And so the next story I built was like, okay, well, the next story is more left-leaning, right? It's not the NPR liberal. It's more left and it's more activism and actually people on the ground. And I put myself into that to the extent that, again, I ended up in jail trying to support another group of people who are protesting the housing authority because someone was being brutalized in front of me. And you just don't even think. I did not clock the guy. And I just tried to separate them. And then that became very dangerous for me. And so then I'm rebuilding the story. I'm constantly rebuilding the story. There's no way that poor people's rights has anything to do with an esoteric DAO tied to an elm tree and the global education futures where they're promoting prenatal university and family university and virtual reality prison and, I mean, trading futures on human capital. None of that is right. And so when I saw that, because you don't presume that people know, and so I texted Sherry because we're not in constant contact, but I still had her number. And I said, hey, I saw your name on this website, this woman, here's a link to her promoting this blockchain Moloch card game. She's promoting it. And here's the white paper for the game. And here's the list. Here's the website of you on their advisory board. I don't understand. And the response I got was like the next morning, thank you for the information. And so there's someone that works with her that I knew who, and he's on staff. and someone with a background in Utah who we had had long conversations about the connections of the LDS Church and EdTech and Powder Mountain and the Utah industrial banking systems and the technology and Silicon Slopes and Bluffdale and community schools and all of the things, right? We had had these conversations. But all I got was, you know, I'll let Sherry know. I don't think she's on that anymore. And I said, she acknowledged the email. She acknowledged the text. She acknowledged the text. She didn't say she wasn't on it. And, you know, ultimately, I guess everyone's entitled to their reality tunnel. If their reality tunnel is that Sherry Honkala and the PPERC folks think that I guess the poor people are, I don't know, you have to buy these cards if they're going to set them up, if some philanthropist is going to set them up with some UBI so that they can play these card games to train a benevolent AI. But that's not what I signed up for. That's not what I was doing when I was trying to raise awareness about pay for success finance and housing and outside in robot and smart technologies and at the time surveillance. I didn't know it might be something else. It's not what I signed up for. And so I told both of them, I replied back because I got kind of worked up. You know, again, my understanding of what I thought my past was, what I was doing at the time, clearly wasn't. And I said, I need to work. I need to talk about this because I'm on record presenting with you guys, being out in public, giving talks in solidarity with PPERC, and now this is inconsistent, and I need to know more. Like, if you're not involved with them or you disagree with this connection or this approach, tell me, because I don't want to misrepresent you. My goal is not to misrepresent, but is to lay out the reality of what is unfolding, because it's entirely unexpected in some ways, but not in others, I guess. And maybe this is just my qualia. Maybe this is just my version of whatever this crazy augmented reality video game is, that Pavel Luksha, all the strings would start pulling back together, right? The tree of knowledge and the Global Education Futures Forum transhumanist tree logo gets folded into this game that somehow connects with anti-poverty. And it's, you know, the woman that is, you know, in very difficult circumstances in Kensington is somehow situated right next to the woman who lives in this, you know, exotic Mauritius island, smart community, whatever, like working on quantum consciousness and evolution. So I don't know what to say, folks. I don't know what to make of things anymore. And I guess everything is so ridiculous that even though I do get, I can't say that I can keep perfect calm about it all. I'm trying to operate from a meta level of at least being able to pause and step back and say, okay, this is what you see. Maybe this is not all there is. We have to see that there maybe is some purpose. Do your part. Be responsible as best you understand what being a responsible person in this bizarre world is, and offer people some information. Yeah, so maybe Sherry and guy that works for her are in reality tunnels where their future is somehow linked to a world constitution that overlaps with a digital singularity game, and that they're very invested in that. And I guess we'll just see how that goes. But, you know, if you're aware of poverty issues and UBI and harmonization, because Joseph has a really good blog about coherence and decoherence and harmony. There is something, I mean, this harmony UBI, the harmony charter schools, the harmony harmonization, the coherence of the quantum. They're after the subtle energy. It's coming through the alternative medicine stuff. It's coming through the alternative education stuff. It's coming through the libertarian stuff. It's coming through all the religion stuff, whether you're the New Age ascension religion or Judeo-Christian religions or Eastern religions. It's all of the things. So I guess we shall just see what comes, where the bumps in the road are. I have a bunch of spring bulbs to plant, so I'm going to go dig up a little bit more of the lawn in my front yard. We finally got rain, which is great, although the geoengineering is not great. So I hope you all are well. I'm going to overlay a few images just to document this, because I just told Sherry, I said, I'm not trying to hang you out to dry, but I don't understand. I don't understand. And given my involvement, you would think somebody would just pick up the phone and say, I don't really know what you just sent me. Can you tell me more about this? This seems a little troubling, or I'll ask this woman about it or something. But it just makes me think that everything I knew and did in the past, there was another layer behind that made it more complicated. So, all right. Be well, everyone.